loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, we discuss the revelation that the FBI had opened a counterintelligence investigation targeting President Trump as a possible Russian agent after he fired James Comey in 2017. And then we continue our weekly half-hour segment called Technology Rules with Chris Garaffa, a guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Senator Lindsey Graham, a Republican from South Carolina and strong supporter of President Trump, urged him today to temporarily reopen the government to allow for talks that could satisfy his demand for a border wall. Anger is mounting as hundreds of thousands of federal employees are going without pay, and polls show that most Americans don't want a border wall, and most blame Trump for the longest government shutdown in history. Next, National Security Advisor John Bolton asked the Pentagon last year to draw up plans to attack Iran, and senior Pentagon officials are voicing deepening fear that he could precipitate a conflict with that country at a time when the U.S. presence in the Middle East is declining. And President Trump said that he would, quote, devastate Turkey economically, unquote, if it attacks the Kurds when the U.S. pulls its troops out of Syria. Then, Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, a Democrat from Hawaii, announced her candidacy for president on Saturday. Gabbard is a decorated veteran of the Iraq War and is a strong proponent of peace issues. She's also the first American Samoan and the first Hindu to be elected to Congress. Pundits believe she may draw support away from Bernie Sanders, but she also has been subject to intense criticism over her record on LGBTQ rights. And then today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And finally, British Prime Minister Theresa May traveled around the country to drum up support ahead of Tuesday's critical parliamentary vote on Brexit. She told voters in Northern England that if Parliament votes down the Brexit deal, there will be no alternative and it will paralyze British politics and likely lead to no Brexit. And in other headlines, Dr. James Watson has had his honors revoked from his longtime workplace after a PBS documentary aired where he continued to support his disproven and racist theories that people of African origin are genetically inferior to people of European origin. Watson, who has won the Nobel Prize, famously discovered the double helix structure of DNA, but in 2007 made public comments about his racist theories, leading many to disavow him. He publicly recanted at that time. Juan Guaido, a right-wing politician who serves as president of Venezuela's National Assembly, was briefly detained over the weekend following comments at a rally where he offered to serve as acting president if the military were to launch a coup to depose President Nicolas Maduro. The government, however, said that the agents who detained Guaido were acting without authorization and they have been fired. President Maduro was recently sworn into office for a second term and faces an intensified U.S.-backed push to remove him from office. Four people are dead in Kabul and more than 90 wounded after a car bomb attack near a foreign compound called Green City. One of the dead was a civilian and at least 23 of the 90 wounded were children. No group has yet claimed responsibility for the attack, but this comes amid conversations between the Taliban and the Afghan government to end the long-standing war there. The government of Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras is facing a vote of no confidence after the nationalist Independent Greeks Party withdrew its support for the government. The crisis was sparked by an agreement between Greece and the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, or FYROM, in which the latter will change its name to the Republic of North Macedonia. However, Tsipras may still be able to rely on his former coalition partners' support in the no confidence vote, as Independent Greeks would be unlikely to reach the threshold to enter parliament in the event of a snap election. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the news about the FBI investigation of Donald Trump. Americans learned over the weekend that the FBI had taken perhaps an unprecedented step by opening a counterintelligence investigation targeting President Trump following his decision to fire former FBI Director James Comey. Shortly after news of the counterintelligence investigation broke, the media began to heavily focus on the availability of the translator's notes from Donald Trump's meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin. We're joined from Minnesota by Colleen Raleigh. Colleen is a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine's Person of the Year, along with two other whistleblowers. And we're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. Daniel is a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Colleen, Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Colleen Raleigh, you know, I have to say, when I heard the news, I wasn't that shocked, but is firing the FBI director by the President of the United States grounds for an FBI investigation then against the President of the United States? I mean, doesn't the FBI director serve at the pleasure of the president? I mean, that's within his realm of authority, no?
Well, if you go by history, for example, every president was afraid of firing J. Edgar Hoover. He was said to be the most he was director for 47 years, and he had acquired so much power in that time frame that the presidents basically just let him die in office. So there is a precedent here for this kind of fear by elected officials of very powerful intelligence directors, and Hoover is a great example of that.
Daniel Lazar, same question.
Yeah, totally unprecedented. And it really took the FBI into constitutionally uncharted waters. I mean, who's in charge here? The FBI or the president? And if the president says something or does something the FBI doesn't like, can the FBI, you know, launch a criminal investigation on what seems to me to be really very shaky grounds?
One of the things, too, that I think we all have to remember is that this isn't something new that the FBI is doing. The FBI went after, for example, Henry Wallace back in the 1940s, accusing him of being somehow tied to the Kremlin. They went after George McGovern in 1972, accusing him of being tied to the Kremlin. So it's not unusual for them to make an accusation, even if it's a wild one. And even if nothing comes up in that investigation, then leak it to the press.
Well, that's true. Henry Wallace was the candidate of the Progressive Party in 1948. He had been FDR's vice president. He hadn't been picked in the last term, unfortunately, right. And thus Harry Truman became vice president. But he ran in 1948 on a program that the U.S. should not have the Cold War with the Soviet Union, that mm-hmm. the U.S. should go back to the U.S.-Soviet military alliance that existed along with Britain, the anti-fascist alliance of World War II. And he was truly red-baited into oblivion.
Yes, he was.
And the same thing happened with McGovern. But Colleen, this is the president. This is not a candidate. Henry Wallace was a candidate. George McGovern was then the candidate for U.S. president in 1972. It reminds me also, if you think back to what Chuck Schumer said in January 2017, right before Donald Trump took office, but Trump was already quarreling with the FBI about the Russian probe. And this is what Schumer said. He said, "It's really dumb to do this," talking about taunting U.S. intelligence agencies. That was a Schumer tweet. Schumer, of course, is the leader of the Democrats in the Senate. "Let me tell you, you take on the intelligence community, they have six ways from Sunday at getting back at you." You remember Schumer said this? That was when he was on Rachel Maddow's show. But wait a second. The president of the United States or the president-elect of the United States, is it right that they're going to be retaliated against, or we should expect there's going to be six ways from Sunday for the FBI to attack somebody because they're under public criticism?
That's why it's correct to conclude that there is a deep state. You don't have to call it that, but it exists. And here's an example of it.
Go ahead, Colleen.
Yeah. And I should also just clarify that when I was talking about J. Edgar Hoover being so powerful, and actually the examples you gave of going after political figures in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and into the 60s even, were all under Hoover. I've read about Hoover actually probably surveilling or listening into Eleanor Roosevelt. He considered her, he hated women to begin with. That was just his personal problem there. And because he hated women, for some reason, he attached on that she was also some kind of enemy of the state. What happens, too, is in a war, time of war, these directors who are then getting more and more powerful with their so-called war powers, with the so-called enemy, is that it's very hard for that not then to migrate back, because they get used to doing these things on foreign enemies. And then, of course, they start talking and they say, oh, so-and-so could be, in league with that foreign power. So it just migrates back home. And all of a sudden, they are spying on domestic officials. It's just a very easy jump. You see this going on also in the UK right now. And I think there's a lot of reasons for it. But one of them is the notion that you're at war with a foreign enemy. And of course, Hoover was using the Cold War for all of this spying on political figures in Washington, D.C. He would gather all this dirt on them and then use it to threaten them, to keep them in line. Speaking of threatening, if you go back to the very early beginning of this, when Trump was briefed, quote unquote, briefed by Brennan, for CIA Director Brennan, Intelligence Director Clapper, and FBI Director Comey on the so-called Russiagate, on all of this report that they had done on Russia. And then at the tail end of that briefing, I think it was on January 6th, before his inauguration, by pre-plan, Brennan and Clapper excuse themselves and they leave Comey in there to do this kind of a threat that, it's going to soon appear in the papers that there's this allegation that you hired prostitutes. This is known as the salacious portion of the Steele memo. And he was kind of threatened by Comey that this was going to appear in the papers. Well, guess what? That's on all fours with what Hoover, et cetera, was doing in order to kind of control and manipulate elected officials.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yep. Daniel Lazard, jump in.
Well, I just want to say a couple of things. First of all, the decision by Obama to greenlight an FBI investigation into Russian influence, it was the first time in American history that one administration commenced a criminal investigation or a national security investigation into another incoming administration. This was unprecedented. And secondly, Trump really, despite all his foibles, had launched the most fundamental challenge to U.S. foreign policy in recent memory by essentially breaking with the anti-Russia policy to which Washington as a whole was deeply committed. So, and the FBI was permeated by this anti-Russian fervor. For example, Lisa Page, a high-ranking FBI person in the FBI Russia investigation, testified before Congress that, quote, Russia poses the greatest threat to Western ideals of any of our foreign adversaries. It is, in my opinion, that with respect to Western ideals and who it is and what it is we stand for as Americas, Russia poses the most dangerous threat to that way of life. So this is the mindset of the people who commenced the investigation into Russian influence. And obviously, Trump was highly suspect because of various, halfway peaceful statements he had made, vis-a-vis Moscow.
We had the FBI investigation that began in the summer of 2016 about whether or not there was Russian collusion with the Trump campaign. That's been going on since 2016. Now it's 2.5 years old. After Trump fired Comey, I think Trump expected the firing of Comey would be greeted with applause by the Democrats because the Democrats had basically blamed Comey with his reopening of the Hillary Clinton email server investigation 11 days before the November 8th, 2016 election as something that was very harmful to the Clinton election prospects. It put a dark cloud, they said, over Clinton. And then Comey basically said, oh, there's nothing to it, and they went on. But nonetheless, Hillary Clinton said this was a big reason for my loss. So Trump thought, okay, I fire Comey, who I don't like. He, as Colleen Raleigh told us, it was Comey who met with Trump in the White House and told him about the Steele dossier. He cleared the room. Comey actually cleared the room and got rid of everybody else so he could meet one-on-one and tell Trump, hey, we have this dossier. And I think it was at that time that Trump said, well, you're going to come out and publicly say I'm not under investigation, right? And Comey didn't go along with that. Anyway, a couple months later, Trump fires Comey. Then what that triggers is the Mueller probe, right? We wouldn't have the Mueller probe except for the firing of Comey. But now we have a second issue of the FBI investigating not candidate Trump or the Trump campaign, but President Trump. And the triggering catalytic event was just that he fired Comey. It seems to me, Colleen, that this can only be viewed by sort of the lay person, let's say us, we the people, as retaliation. I mean, retaliation because the FBI didn't want James Comey to be fired.
Yeah, and I think there could frankly even be one more layer to this, which is that when they began those investigations, which were already, you know, if you think about it, out on a limb, putting Carter Page under surveillance, you know, who was a, you know, peripherally related to the campaign. And when they did that, that went on for a year and it went on, you know, for some time. What happens is the agency then gets invested. And so people start to worry, you know, John, it's a little bit like the torture program in a way. It's very similar because then people, they have to be invested in it because at that point, they know eventually it's going to come out. And now they're working to put the best spin on when this news later breaks. And so they continue in many cases to even kind of, you know, it's kind of like they always say the cover up is worse than the actual first wrongdoing.
Yes.
And I, and that, of course, that was the case with Nixon. And I think that that could also be another layer to this, especially with the selection of Mueller, who they know already has. I've written an article about this, but he had a longstanding history of being the man to go to for cover up. And, you know, that was even if you even go all the way back to the Whitey Bulger fiasco in Boston, there's some pretty good evidence that Mueller was involved in that. I wrote my memo because of Mueller's statements that there was nothing that we could have done, that we had no intelligence to prevent 9/11. And that was part of this immediate cover up. He was director a week, just 1 week, and he was already at it. And so I think he could have been, there were thousands of attorneys, qualified attorneys, maybe even tens of thousands of qualified attorneys that could have been selected for if you had really wanted an objective, independent special prosecutor. But in this case, they pick the guy in the Washington, D.C., who perhaps has the biggest conflict of interest because he's somebody who already is invested and he has this longstanding track record of protecting his agencies. So, and of course, also personal acquaintance, longstanding personal involvement with Comey and many of the players. So again, this is the oddest thing in the world. And people should really view the whole thing with a lot more skepticism.
Yeah. Let's go back again. You know, Daniel Lazar asked the question, who's the real power here? Is it the president or is it the FBI?
I think that's a legitimate question to ask.
Yeah. And Colleen Raleigh is telling us that for the longest time, the real power was J. Edgar Hoover.
That's right.
Presidents came and go, but Hoover had dirt on everybody, was willing to use dirt. And also, they were afraid of him, whether deserved or undeserved. They were afraid. And thus, you know, in many ways, J. Edgar Hoover was the power. Now, if we think back to what brought Nixon down, it was, of course, the Watergate burglary. But then, as Colleen's talking about, it wasn't really the burglary. It was the expose of the cover-up of the burglary and the role of the Republican committee to reelect the president, right? Okay, who was Deep Throat? Who was the individual who provided Woodward and Bernstein the information for the Washington Post stories that finally revealed Nixon's wrongdoing? That was none other than Mark Felt.
That's right.
And who was Mark Felt? He was the number two man in the FBI for the longest time under J. Edgar Hoover. Interesting. Anyway, go ahead, Daniel.
Well, I think you're right. The whole point is the FBI guards its turf very carefully, and it's quite unclear as to whether it's on top or the elected officials are on top. And in the case of Trump, the FBI is a self-appointed guardian of national security, and faced with the president, who they, I think, and I think for no good reason, suspected of being a foreign agent, they took it upon themselves to launch a criminal investigation with no political oversight. And to me, that raises the gravest constitutional concerns. I mean, you know, once again, like, no, who's in power? Where does real power lie? Does it lie with elected officials or with the permanent bureaucracy, otherwise known as the deep state?
Of course, we had, Colleen, that other Trump refused to answer the question initially about whether he was an agent of Russia when it was posed to him by media outlets this weekend, because he said it's offensive.
Yeah.
But then I think it was the New York Times I read this morning. It says Trump refused to answer question about whether he was a Russian agent. Now, later today, all day, Trump has been saying, no, I'm not a Russian agent, because just saying it was offensive was interpreted then or used in the media to say, ah, see, he won't answer the question. Pretty ludicrous. When, I mean, we're not pro-Trump, John. You and I are not pro-Trump. If anything, we're talking about all of Trump's awful policies.
Yep.
But let's face facts. I mean, this is a media manipulation, and it would seem to me to be an FBI manipulation of their power, of their authority, again, and the media taking almost everything out of context to have this reinforcing narrative about everything. So people who aren't really digging deep don't really see the falsity of some of this. Go ahead, Colleen.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually offended at even the thought of being called a Trump supporter simply because you are questioning this really, like I said, beyond bizarre scenario that we find ourselves in now. I think it's actually more unprecedented than Watergate, for that matter. But when you question it or you say, hey, this makes no sense, you're immediately jumped on as being a Trump supporter. And literally, I went across the street to have coffee with most of these people. But on the other hand, facts are facts. You know, I think that the whole situation now, there's a pattern of media leaks. And you were going over the media here, but there's this pattern. And now we know some of the officials involved actually are very adept. We don't know the source of all the media leaks. And that's also, if you think about it, that's kind of strange, because when John and I and other whistleblowers were out there, the government was just crazy over finding who's the leak. And now these stories will make it into the New York Times or whatever, and nobody even seems to care except Trump. And then he's criticized for wanting to find the source of the leak. But we do know that some of the players are the leakers. And I think there's a track record right now of leaking things, floating things to the public in order to manipulate public opinion. And then slowly, you know, they're doing it very carefully and very almost sophisticated, in a very sophisticated way, whoever is doing all this leaking. And I think that that's just another element that should cause people to have grave skepticism about the narrative and the story, and not really watch what goes on the nightly news and buy it whole cloth.
You know, that is such an important point. And this is the danger of the FBI's role in this so-called deep state, is that they control the information, they collect the information, and then they selectively leak the investigation to sway public opinion. That's what's so dangerous. I mean, it's not an accident that journalists over the weekend started calling Donald Trump a Russian agent or a Russian dupe or whatever it is they're calling him. That was leaked by the FBI, and it was done to serve their purpose.
Daniel Lazar, let's move on to another topic. Again, treated as breaking news that Donald Trump, quote, destroyed the notes or wouldn't let the note takers reveal any information about his private discussions with Vladimir Putin. Again, coming on top of this news. So that seems to indicate to the public Trump is hiding something, and maybe he and Putin were talking about, like, the payoff that Trump was getting because he's nothing other than the Manchurian candidate.
Yeah, right.
Again, this was not news. I'm looking back to when Putin and Trump had their meeting in Helsinki. That was the report from the Washington Post back then that Trump didn't want to have a record made public about what they talked about. And yet it seems now like it's breathlessly reported breaking news about Trump and Putin and Trump concealing from the public and from other government officials what he actually said with Putin. Go ahead.
Yeah, you're right. It's just part of this Democratic Party campaign to try to somehow to delegitimize Trump which is not a very difficult thing to do, of course, and to sort of score points and urge the FBI on. I mean, a private talk between the U.S. president and a Russian and a Soviet leader, a Russian leader, it's hardly unprecedented. I mean, the most famous example of a private talk that Ronald Reagan had with Mikhail Gorbachev in Reykjavik in 1986, which led to a major anti-missile treaty that Trump and Bolton are now in the process of tearing up. But, you know, for everyone to sort of like to run around in circles and to, you know, to cackle and gobble about private talks between Trump and Putin, I think is extremely cynical. But the role of the press, I think, which is most important, is that it's cheering on the FBI's claim to be a kind of a national arbiter as to what constitutes national security without any oversight by the elected branches. And this is very dangerous, and yet the press essentially is lending its voice.
Indeed they are. The Washington Post: President Trump has gone to extraordinary lengths to conceal details of his conversations with Russian President Vladimir Putin, including on at least one occasion taking possession of notes of his own interpreter, instructing the linguist not to discuss what had transpired with other administration officials, current and former. Okay, maybe Trump is concerned that not everybody in his administration is on the same wavelength about Russian policy. Certainly Mattis, in his resignation letter, made it quite clear a couple of weeks ago, he didn't agree with Trump on Russia and China. But then when you go back to in the same story, Rex Tillerson was in the meeting, one of those meetings where Trump didn't want the notes to go out. Maybe Rex Tillerson might also be a source. It sounds like Trump is meeting in private, in secret, as if we don't know that there's a meeting going on, Colleen.
And, you know, let me interrupt Colleen for one second. Colleen, before we go right back to you, I spent a lot of years in this world, right? And this is not normal. What's normal is you have practically an army of people in that meeting, or if it's really sensitive, you have your translator and your national security advisor. Even when a president does a phone call to a foreign leader, there are another two or three people on the phone just listening and taking notes. So to have a private meeting with a foreign leader, especially one as important as Vladimir Putin, and then to not have an aide, and then to take the translator's notes, I never heard of such a thing.
So you think the Post is onto something? I don't know.
On that one issue, I think they have it right. But I think that their conclusion is incorrect. I think that Trump just doesn't know better. This isn't his world. He's never done this before. He's treating this like a CEO would treat it.
Okay. Colleen, you get the last word.
Yeah. And I will also, I hate to defend Trump, but if I was president and for 2 years, this kind of leaking and backstabbing had been going on, I think it would make almost anyone a little bit paranoid. I listened to Melania Trump do an interview, and she mentioned that she is afraid of backstabbing, you know, different things that have happened. And so I think that, you know, in a way, it may all almost be deliberate, trying to make the president even more paranoid and more overreacting than he should be. Who knows? I don't know if that's the case, but certainly this kind of a media bias is really unprecedented. And if I was the president, I would probably become paranoid as well.
That's Colleen Rowley. We talked to Colleen from Minnesota. She's a former FBI special agent who in 2002 was named Time Magazine Person of the Year along with two other whistleblowers. And we're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. Daniel is a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules, with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut, by web developer and technologist Chris Garafa. Chris, welcome back.
Hey, Brian and John. Great to be back.
Let's get started. We have different categories here. We're talking about privacy in the surveillance state. We're talking about law enforcement issues. We're talking about corporate surveillance, meaning Facebook, Google, Amazon, Apple. We're talking about artificial intelligence and robots. We're talking about the military and the militarization of outer space. Let's start with privacy, Chris Garofa. Where should we go?
Well, you know, I wanted to start with this as a quick note. It didn't quite fit in, but very interestingly enough, you know, folks might remember that a few years ago, a treasure trove of NSA hacking tools was released by a group called the Shadow Brokers. That's a hacking group. And they, you know, they put these out on the internet, and some of these NSA tools have actually been used in cyber attacks since then, particularly in Eastern Europe that spread across Europe. Now, I bring this up because there was a report last week that Kaspersky Labs actually helped the NSA identify who leaked those. Apparently, it was an NSA contractor named Harold Martin. He was arrested in August of 2016 for this leak. But this report is just now coming out that it was Kaspersky Labs, which is a Russian-owned company, that helped get this information to the NSA to track this guy down. The reason this is so interesting is that since 2017, Congress actually has made it illegal for the U.S. government to buy Kaspersky's products, saying that there was some sort of threat that because they're a Russian company, their antivirus software was, you know, reporting back to Russia or, you know, something like that, this whole Russiagate nonsense. So I wanted to bring this up because it's been very underreported, of course, in the mass media that this company actually that has been so condemned by the U.S. government to the point that the 27 National Defense Authorization Act outright banned the U.S. government from buying their products, actually did work with the U.S. government to track this guy Harold Martin down, who supposedly leaked some NSA internal tools.
I don't understand why, though. Why did they do that? And they did it on their own. It's not like the FBI or NSA went to them and asked for their help. They discovered this and they went on their own to U.S. authorities. Why'd they do that?
That's right. I think they wanted to stay on the good side of the U.S. government, of the NSA. Of course, you know, this was as, you know, Russia nonsense was sort of picking up. You know, there were implications even before the election that Trump was somehow involved with something to do with Russia, of course. And that may have played a part in it.
We talked to Kim Vetter, who authored this article, this revelation. We talked to her last week. She wrote for Politico. In this case, she also writes for the New York Times and the Washington Post. I mean, it's quite a story. She quoted in her article Stuart Baker, the general counsel for the NSA in the 1990s, and he's currently a partner at Steptoe and Johnson. Quote, "It's irony piled on irony that people worked at Kaspersky, who were already in the sights of the U.S. intelligence community, disclosed to them that they had this problem." It's also discouraging that Baker said, he noted that the NSA apparently still hasn't figured out a good way, this is a quote, a good way to find unreliable employees who are mishandling some of their most sensitive stuff. Now, again, John, as you and I talked about with Kim Vetter, these are allegations against Martin. Martin had sent, apparently because Kaspersky tracked it back, strange Twitter direct messages. Mm-hmm. Thus, Kaspersky was concerned because the timing was such that it was about 30 minutes before or 30 minutes after the shadow broker leaks of online NSA tools. In other words, they leaked online NSA tools. Again, we don't know. Martin's defense, I believe, is that he didn't have anything to do with this leak, that he's a hoarder, that's why he kept all of this intelligence. He kept it from different agencies for 20 years. So we don't want to prejudge Martin, because we don't know. The trial hasn't yet happened. But it is an irony upon irony that it was Kaspersky, the demonized Russian-owned, not Russian government.
Right.
It's a Russian boss, a Russian employer who owns who's the CEO of the company. Anyway, interesting story. Let's go on to the next one, Chris.
Well, you know, Donald Trump has nominated a man named William Barr for attorney general, and the ACLU has a really great rundown on why this is a really bad choice for anyone who's concerned about the Fourth Amendment and privacy. It goes back. The ACLU says he was the godfather of the NSA's bulk data collection program. So, I mean, going back to the early 90s, he and Robert Mueller, people know that name now, they say began amassing phone call data in bulk for the DEA, having, you know, working with the telephone companies for not just the U.S., but over 100 nations to collect cell phone data from people they believe to be drug traffickers. And it goes on because the DEA program was what the NSA's phone collection program was based on. And of course, that became legal, or it was authorized under the Patriot Act in 2001 that nearly every member of Congress voted for at the time. Of course, it was then found to be illegal in federal court. And then we've talked about in the past how Congress tried to, you know, reform it, but that reform hasn't gone nearly far enough. And we don't believe it's had a significant effect. So people need to be opposing William Barr, calling their senators, putting pressure on them to do not vote this guy William Barr in. He is a significant threat to our Fourth Amendment rights, to our rights to privacy. And it's going to be a disaster specifically with him if he's going to be serving as attorney general.
Yeah, I want to add something to that, too. He has repeatedly over the years, since he was in the George W. Bush administration, come out publicly in favor of weakening federal whistleblower protection laws. He's the enemy of whistleblowers. In addition, I heard from a very well-placed source on Capitol Hill just on Friday that Senator Rand Paul, a Republican of Kentucky, is going to lead the fight against Barr's nomination among Republicans. What I don't trust is the likes of Dianne Feinstein and Mark Warner, who have said very nice things about Barr. But if the Democrats can hold together against him and Rand Paul can draw one more Republican, his nomination can be defeated.
Yeah. Again, Barr was the attorney general. He was the 77th attorney general from 1991 to 1993 when George H.W. Bush left office. He was also in many ways, the architect of the mass incarceration system.
Without a doubt.
Certainly its advocate within the George H.W. Bush administration, something that the Clinton administration adopted.
Yeah.
And again, I'm glad Chris Garofa pointed out about the ACLU's argument. Here's from the ACLU. While serving in the George H.W. Bush administration, Barr helped develop what became a blueprint for the National Security Agency's mass phone surveillance program. In 1992, he and his then deputy, Robert Mueller, authorized the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, to begin amassing phone call data in bulk, ordering telephone companies to secretly hand over the records of all phone calls from the U.S. to countries, which eventually grew to be well over 100 nations where the government believed drug traffickers were operating. So just a reminder to all the so-called progressives and liberals who now love Robert Mueller,
that's
but
right,
maybe oppose William Barr, that they were in cahoots, of course, because Robert Mueller is that person. And he's been that person for a long time, including after 9/11, authorizing the roundup of thousands of Muslim and Arab American and South Asian people, not because of what they did, but because of who they were. In other words, there were preemptive arrests or detentions or calling people in to have them validate that they were, in fact, not Al-Qaeda. Chris Garofa, let's go on to the next story.
Yeah, so this is just a trend that has been noticed and talked about, you know, a lot, especially around Christmas gifts, but, you know, just overall, right, how many new products out there are just making people so used to the idea of a surveillance state, adults, teenagers, even young children. So there's a story in Quartz about parents using GPS ankle monitors to track their kids, in this case, you know, teenagers. But that, you know, and that's nothing new, right? People have been putting devices in their cars.
Wait. Putting bracelets on your kids for GPS tracking
ankle
is
bracelets.
Not new?
Well, no, this type of GPS monitoring is not new. The ankle bracelets are something new. It used to be that, and it still is, you can, you know, track if you're on a family plan, you can track somebody else's cell phone on your family plan. But kids got smart and started turning the phone off or turning the, you know, GPS off. So now they have these ankle bracelets that people are using to track. I mean, Quartz says, track their teenagers like criminals. But it's getting people so used to the idea of monitoring and privacy violations. Another thing was, you know, the toy Elf on the Shelf, which I wasn't really super familiar with until this Christmas season. But basically, you know, the idea is that it's watching you and reporting back to Santa every night, right? Whether you've been naughty or nice. So this is for very young children being told basically, hey, you're being watched all the time. and were reporting back to Santa. Well, when does Santa become the NSA or the FBI? At what point does that happen? You know, I'm not a parent. I'm not going to tell anyone how to parent their children, but I think we all need to be aware of how ingrained this surveillance state idea is in our society at the behest of the surveillance state, using these kind of technologies that could be used for good to just promote the idea that it's okay to be watched 24 hours a day. It's okay to have this toy in your child's bedroom that's telling them that having a camera on you all the time is okay. And this is an ongoing conversation in the privacy world where we're trying to figure, you know, we're discussing how do we balance the use of technology with not making people complacent with the idea that they are going to be monitored all the time unless we do something about it.
The Elf on the Shelf was a Christmas book, right? Back in... In 2005, about elves were in the house watching you, but now it's a technology. Wow. Chris is not a parent, John, but you're a parent.
I'm a parent, and just yesterday, my 7-year-old taught me that if you take a knife and slit open the Elf on the Shelf, that while you kill him, he has diamonds inside his belly.
Really?
Yes.
Is that also true? Are there diamonds in the Elf on the Shelf?
I don't know. There were no diamonds in ours.
Okay, so anyway, this is awful. This is bad. I can't believe parents are treating their kids as this like under house arrest. Your whole childhood is going to be under house arrest.
Basically, yeah. And it's bad enough that iPhones, for example, come with software, the app already loaded to track your children's phone.
I want to tell young people around America, as Chairman Mao said, it is right to rebel. Anyway, let's go on to the next story.
Okay, so we obviously all know that Facebook is tracking us. Facebook is watching us. Everything that everything we do, Facebook, you know, if we have an account, they're watching. There was a report that came out of the 35th Chaos Computer Congress. This is an event that happens regularly every year, usually in somewhere in Europe, where hackers get together and talk about their research, what they're working on. A report shows that apps on Android are actually sharing data with Facebook, even if you don't have an account. Facebook provides services and tools that you can put into your app to, you know, in theory do other, you know, not just log in with Facebook, but also to help with other development tasks. But these things, these they're called SDKs, software development kits, are still reporting information back to you, whether even if you don't have a Facebook account, even if you don't have the Facebook app itself or a Messenger app or Instagram on your phone. These researchers looked and actually said that they were able to see that information was being transmitted back to Facebook, even in cases where Facebook had never touched that phone. There had never been an account login, never installed any Facebook-owned apps. Now, so one of the things is, if you do log in, then Facebook knows, okay, this is John's phone. Mm-hmm. And then when that information is sent back from your phone in one of these other apps to Facebook, they can then correlate it. So some of the apps that they point out that were in this is Qibla Connect, which is a Muslim prayer app, Period Tracker Clue, a period tracker, the job search app Indeed, and other apps. So they could then profile you. Let's say you're using all of those apps. They could say you're likely female, likely Muslim, and looking for a job potentially. And they can do that even if Facebook doesn't have an account for you, or they can't tie your account to this. Now, in the realm of big data, you can always tie bits of information together, and you can get so specific that, in fact, you can identify a person by the right combination of data, whether it's interest and location, how often that person is active, what times they're active, where they regularly go, all of that. And so Facebook should not be doing this. Facebook should not obviously be sending this information back without the explicit permission of the user. It shouldn't be up to the developer of the application, and it shouldn't be up to Facebook itself. It should be up to the user who is using these apps.
And Chris, you told us last week that you actually read some of these terms of agreement. Is there anything in the Facebook terms of agreement that would allow them to do this? Like, is there any way that they are informing us that they're doing it and we just aren't paying attention?
Well, this is a little different because this isn't the Facebook service that you and I use. This is tools that Facebook gives to application developers to help them, for example. So with some of these apps that I mentioned, you can log in via your Facebook account to this app. That way you don't need to remember another password and do all that. And it can, you know, save your information between, you know, say you get a new phone, it saves your information. So you can do that. And so we don't even have the option because Facebook isn't targeting the average user with these SDKs, the software development kits. Facebook is actually, they're targeting developers and then using that. And whether the developers know this is happening or not is an entirely different story. They might not even expect this. So this really is down to Facebook, but also on developers to know that they're doing this and to be aware that by adding a Facebook kit to your application, you are risking your user's privacy.
Well, I wanted to ask you also about something that you flagged for us, and this is about Amazon's Ring security cameras. Very cool invention. They're cheap. They're everywhere. You can get them at Best Buy and Target and Amazon. I even went out and bought a couple, although I haven't put them up yet. Anyway, there's an article in The Intercept saying that strangers can actually watch what your Ring camera is broadcasting. How does that work?
Yeah, well, so Ring uses a service, a storage service called Amazon S3. It's just basically, you know, it's a cloud service. You upload files and you can share them with other people. And if you use this properly, it's locked down and only the people that you want to have access could have access to it. Unfortunately, what Amazon did was they didn't lock down those S3 folders. And so people who the videos were going and being stored on these folders, that if you found it, anyone could actually download these videos. And this was found out because The Intercept did some research on this, and Ring actually works with a Ukrainian company to analyze and look through some of these videos. Some of the videos were not even encrypted. So encryption would mean that, you know, you need a key or a password to actually view the video. It would be one extra step of security. But some of these videos weren't even encrypted. And so this Ukrainian company's folder that they were going to go in and get these videos from was actually open to the world. It's not clear how many people were impacted just yet. There were some initial reports, but it's not really clear. But what it does say is that, you know, basically Ring and Amazon, therefore, have access to like a global view, effectively, of the world. The article compares it to Uber's God Mode map that appears where, you know, shows that like where every single passenger and every single driver are in the entire country. Ring could have that, you know, that has the capacity to have that same kind of view of every single Ring doorbell neighborhood in the country. And they're clearly not securing it well enough.
Yeah, again, I want to read a couple sentences from this article in The Intercept, and people can read it for themselves. It's called, "For owners of Amazon's Ring security cameras, strangers may have been watching too." The person who wrote the article is Sam Biddle. The date of the article is January 10th, 2019. Here's a couple sentences. It's really important information, I think, and I don't see it being covered too widely.
No.
"Despite its missions to keep people and their property secure, the company's treatment of customer video feeds has been anything but," people familiar with the company's practices told The Intercept. "Beginning in 2016, according to one source, Ring provided its Ukraine-based research and development team," that's what Chris was telling us about, "virtually unfettered access to a folder on Amazon's S3 cloud storage service that contained every video created by every Ring camera around the world. That would amount to an enormous list of high-sensitive files that could be easily browsed and viewed. Downloading and sharing these customer video files would have required little more than a click." What about false and deceptive advertising? Again, isn't that exactly what this is? They're telling you, hey, this is a way for you to know what's going on at your property or your home or your apartment in order to keep it safe. Again, I think this whole thing is a bad idea, generally speaking. I think it's people are making a big mistake to employ. But that said, it seems to me on its face to be false and deceptive advertising when, unbeknownst to the customer and the client, they're creating a folder with your video file and every video file in the world to a Ukrainian-based research and development team and they can do with it and dispense with it what they choose to do, because who's got oversight there?
That's right. You know, I've had this conversation a lot, actually quite a bit this morning too, about not knowing what these companies are doing with our information and not even realizing that we are providing them with the resources to train their models, to, you know, learn more about not just us, but just about really the world in general, to make more money off of us. Ultimately, this all goes to companies making more money, right? So if they can train their facial recognition, if they can train their motion recognition based on these videos, that's what they're going to do. And I talked about this with some folks this morning in the context, I don't know if you folks have seen this thing on Facebook where you go and you post a photo of yourself 10 years ago and you post a photo of yourself today.
It's like wildfire.
Yeah, it seems like fun. And I actually went back and found some photos and was kind of embarrassed of my, you know, and I didn't post them, you know, and it's not dangerous in itself, but Facebook, even if they didn't start this, which, you know, they probably didn't, they could still use this information to enhance their facial recognition system, because now they have a dated archive of, okay, exactly 10 years ago, you looked like this, and now you look like this. They can correlate, okay, this is how people age. This is how people of different races or of different ages, this is how their faces change when they age, and then use that in future facial recognition programs, which, you know, if they sell that technology or use it for nefarious purposes, could be very dangerous to people. I'm not saying people shouldn't go post those, you know, the 10-year difference pictures, but be aware of what these companies are doing with our data. And I think that's the important thing here with the Ring doorbells as well. I mean, and really anything that we're doing online.
Well, why not tell them? Maybe I'm too out of it. I don't understand fully. It just seems to be a bad idea. No matter whatever, you know, personal, instant, immediate, short-term gratification that someone gets by doing this and sharing it with their friends, whatever, or family, it seems to me just to be, in all instances, just an additional vulnerability because, again, as Chris is telling us, Facebook can do whatever it will do or wants to do, and what we know it wants to do is to enhance their own capacity for facial recognition for their own commercial purposes, but ultimately, as the surveillance state and this surveillance machinery grows, none of that is going to benefit us in any particular way, and it could do us a lot of harm.
That's right. That's right. So let's be, you know, people should be aware, especially when these things that ask you, okay, you know, post the name of the street you grew up on, and then your mother's maiden name, and that's your, you know, that's your rock star name, right? People do that because it's instant gratification, it's fun, but you're just giving away this private information about you that can be used not just by Facebook, but also by individuals who might be looking to take over your phone account or your credit cards, you know, that kind of information that you often use as security questions. So yes, people need to be aware of what, you know, it's fun, it's, you know, cute to look at, but what does it really mean?
Let's go on to the next story.
You know, I know we're running a little low on time, so I want to talk about this huge story from Motherboard that Joseph Cox wrote. It's called, I mean, this is a pretty good summary, "I gave a bounty hunter $300, then he located our phone." So this applied to Sprint, AT&T, and T-Mobile. We know these companies track and store where our phones are. What they also do is they sell that information to other private companies. Some of them say they're using it just for law enforcement. But Joseph Cox was able to get a phone, give the bounty hunter a phone number, and the bounty hunter found him within, he says, a few hundred meters for just $300. And these are companies that people can use to figure out where a phone number is at any time, so including right now. And it's, again, not just used by police or, you know, federal agencies. It could be done by effectively anyone if you have the money and know how to contact one of these companies. So T-Mobile, Sprint, AT&T, all of them have, since this report came out, said, okay, we are going to stop doing this. We are going to stop selling your information, your location information, to other companies. But they're only doing it, you know, because they're only taking this financial hit because of the mass outrage that happened. I do want to point out, you know, Google, which has its own phone service, had demanded that these companies not do that to Google subscribers because Google wants to own your location information. It was not a nice move of Google to make. It was that they wanted to have this information for themselves and not share it because Google, above all, is an advertising and information company, not a phone carrier or search engine or, you know, photo drop engine or, you know, whatever it is. So now these companies are saying that they are going to stop. They are going to not sell your location information anymore. Of course, do we trust that? But the second question is, you know, that they're still not going to stop sharing it with law enforcement when they get requests or subpoenas to do it. But I do want people to go read this story by Joseph Cox in Motherboard. It's from January 8th to go see exactly how easy he did a really great write up on this. But go see exactly how easy it was to work through this chain of seven companies effectively that had his information.
Chris Garafa, we have about 2 minutes left, and I know we want to spend 1 minute on the tech tip. Let's talk about in the next minute, though, the issue of the militarization of outer space. What's there? Let's flag that.
Well, China landed an amazing thing and landed on the far side of the moon, it's commonly called the dark side of the moon. This is something that the U.S. and no other country have ever done because it's actually quite difficult because of the fact that, you know, it's hard to get the radio signals back. You don't have a direct view from, you know, for the radio signals to control and communicate with that probe that's landing on the moon. Now, China did this, and it's important to talk about this, not just because of how great of a, you know, technological achievement this was, but also in the context of the militarization of outer space, with Trump calling for his, you know, Space Command, Space Force, basic, you know, sort of Star Wars style Death Star kind of stuff that he's got in his head, right? So Trump, the army actually made some statements about how concerning it was that China was going into space right after this happened. This is a scientific probe that landed on the moon. This was not a weapon in space that we know, you know, the U.S. government is working on and that Trump especially wants to build with U.S. Space Force. So this is just another arena where, you know, China and the U.S. and the U.S. particularly is going to be attacking China and working against China.
And of course, NASA administrators, Chris Garafa, believe that, quote, private companies will eventually dominate the marketplace, close quote, for low Earth orbit travel. Interesting. Anyway, 45 seconds left. What's our tech tip?
Well, real quick on that, SpaceX just said they're laying off 10% of its workforce. So that's what that private company gets you. Real quick for the tech tip, there's a lot of advertisements out there now for services like Clio and others who will look at your bank account and figure out what subscriptions you're paying for or pay a parking ticket for you because you're too busy to do it. I want to make people aware and tell people not to use these because you're effectively giving these apps that you don't know who made them or how trustworthy they are. You're giving them information to your bank account, your credit card, your driving information, all of that, and trusting that they're not going to sell your data or just lose it. You wouldn't hand $20 to a guy on the street saying, hey, I'm starting up a bank because he has a cardboard box. You also shouldn't hand your bank account information to any of these apps, especially the ones who have not been proven to, you know, to value your security just yet.
That's the voice of Chris Garafa. We talk to Chris every Monday in this segment of Loud and Clear called Technology Rules, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedom, civil rights, and civil liberties. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.